We'll hear argument next in number 2011, 1173, and 1200. Wait
morning
for
to
a
the
moment,
court. Mr. Quack.
If you can wait for just a moment until everybody gets settled, we've got to clear the traffic here. Everybody's about ready to go. Very well. Mr. Quack, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court, Your Honor, is about industrial truck scales. Thankfully, more straightforward than single and multi-mode transfer modes, hopefully. There's two patents involved in this case, the 547 and the 052 patent. There's one issue for the 547 patent, and that's claim construction. Very simply, should the means plus function limitations be limited to a very specific type of analog to digital converter, or should those means plus function limitations have been construed more broadly to cover the generic class of A to D converters known in the art? And the answer is that the district court erred. The evidence showed that one of skill in the art, reading the 547 patent, would have recognized and linked a generic A to D converter structure to that function. And why is that? Well, we first look at the claims language itself. The claim functions of these means plus function limitations claim generic functions that can be performed by any type of analog to digital converter. For example, the means for providing a digital representation. All A to D converters do that. That's what they do, an analog to digital conversion. If you look at the record, it's undisputed. Both experts admitted that the A to D converter was a very well-known device in the art since the 1950s. This device was known, and standing here today, it probably wouldn't be a stretch to say that it's one of the most well-known devices in the world. Even if you ask a non-engineer what is an analog to digital converter, I think they would probably look at you a little funny and say, well, the title tells you what it is. It's an analog to digital conversion, and a device that does that.
I think the issue, though, is whether or not the only thing linked to the function is the multi-slope version of analog to digital converter.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, if you look at the 547 patent, I think the generic A to D converter is disclosed in multiple places. The abstract, the background, figure 5 has a big block.
The problem you have is in the abstract, there's no linking to any function. It's just articulation of various structures you'll find. So you don't have anything clearly linked, which is required for definiteness.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that in this case is a very specific case because the linking is provided by the name of the device itself. Again, the function is a means for providing a digital representation. The name of the device is an analog to digital converter. So the linking, again, is provided by the name of the device itself. Also, the record is clear, and there is a lot of testimony that this device is such a well-known device and that anybody of ordinary skill looking at this would understand that an A to D converter performs these functions. And another telling piece of evidence.
Just to make sure I'm on the right limitation, means for producing digital representations of loads applied to said counterforce?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so that doesn't jump out to my mind as A to D converter, just looking at those things. Granted, I'm not one of skill in the art,
right.
But nonetheless, it's not like it says means for converting something from analog to digital signal, which would be so apparent, even I could get a hit over the head with it and realize it happened. So means for producing digital signal representations of loads applied to said counterforce.
Right.
Okay, so you are suggesting the abstract alone, if that were the only place in the spec that A to D converter was ever disclosed, would adequately be linking it to that particular function?
I still think so, Your Honor, because, again, a means for providing a digital representation of a load. The load is just a signal, the weight reading for the object. So basically, it takes the analog load signal and converts it to a digital load signal. So all A to D converters would do that, and so extra addition of the language of the load I don't think changes anything. I think that, again, the record was clear that one of ordinary skill, these devices were so well known that they would know that these types of functions were provided by this this device. And what's telling is, if you look at the record at trial about BTEC's expert testifying about the Avery reference. The Avery reference was a prior art reference relied upon by BTEC, and it was three pages. And the only thing it said about A to D converters was there was a line that said, sentence that said, instrumentation for converting an analog signal to a digital signal. And the BTEC expert said, ah, that is an A to D converter. And so that's further testimony that if you get a simple statement, and BTEC expert argued that that Avery reference anticipated the 547 patent. So that's further evidence that one of ordinary skill, looking at the 547, which has similar language, it all it says is it converts an analog signal to a digital signal, would also understand that the A to D converter performs that function.
Well, with all respect, it doesn't say converts an analog signal to a digital signal. It says means for producing digital representation of loads.
Right. I'm talking about the specification. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm talking about the specification. So in this case, if there's any case where a simple reference to a known structure provides a structure for a means-plus function limitation, I believe this is it, because the record is so clear that this is such a well-known device, and the name of the device itself, we believe, provides the link to the function as well as other testimony in the record. The cases that
does
we cited...
every analog-to-digital converter always produce digital representations of loads?
Not loads, Your Honor, but it...
Right. That's why I feel like there has to be something more linking it. That's why I feel like just mentioning analog-to-digital converter as one element in a large invention isn't adequate to link it to that particular function.
Again, I understand your point, Your Honor, but the load is basically, in this case, is just a signal. And if you put signal in for load, that's what all analog-digital converters do. It takes an analog signal and converts it to a digital signal. An analog signal for load, and converts it to a digital signal for load.
Go ahead.
For one of ordinary skill in the art, based on all the testimony that we cited to in the record, I believe would understand that the A to D converter, generic A to D converter references in the specification would be linked to that function as well. The rationale provided in the Federal Circuit cases that we cited to, the S3 NVIDIA case and the Bud v. Harley-Davidson case, supports our position. And the rationale behind the case is you should be able to just say simply a known device and leave it at that, because you don't have to provide all this detail, where patents would be thousands of pages long than 50 pages long, which we don't want. The key difference between the facts of this case and the facts of the cases, the Northern District cases that BTEC cited to in their briefs, was that in those cases, the black box, there was no evidence that these were known structures in the art, where in this case, that testimony was undisputed and is very clear. Also in columns 3 and 6, we talked about the abstract, the background. Columns 3 and 6, there's reference to in the 547 patent, there's reference to a generic A to D converter as well, without reference to a specific type. Also, the district court's claim construction, the district court even said in analyzing 547 that it discloses a general A to D converter. And yet, for some reason, he found that it didn't. The means language didn't cover that general A to D converter. There was no disavowal of scope in the intrinsic record, the patent, or the file history over other types of A to D converters. There was no statement saying that the multi-slope A and D converter is advantageous or there's advantages to use that. There was nothing like that. It was just a preferred embodiment. Because the 547 patent discloses a generic A to D converter for performing the claim function, the means plus function limitation should cover this known structure. The district court's own definitions from the 052 patent in this case highlight the errors in the claim construction. This is the same patent, or not the same patent, but it was filed on the same day. It had the same inventor, same description basically with respect to the A to D converters, same figure, the same means plus function limitations, opposite definitions. The court for the 547 said it had to be a multi-slope. For the 052, the court said it could be any type of A to D converter. So we believe that highlights the errors that the court made in claim construction.
But that doesn't prove which way the court got it wrong.
Yes, Your Honor. He could have had...
That only gets you up to 50%. Yeah,
exactly, Your Honor. But it does highlight the fact that he did make statements that the 547 did disclose this. And he didn't provide any...
But there is different language, to be fair to the...
There is different language, but we don't think that is substantive enough to have different readings at all in terms of the language.
That is what... I mean, there's no question that that is what the trial judge was attentive to, was the differences in language, and that focused on the differences. That, I mean, it's not as if this one slipped by him, that he failed to realize that he had an inconsistency here and to deal with it. Well, you would agree with that.
Respectfully, I would disagree with that, Your Honor, because I don't think that there was any language in his order saying that the differences in the two specs causes different claim constructions at all. In fact, he said in the 547 that it discloses a generic A to D converter. So I think that it was an error, a complete error, that he had inconsistent definitions.
Okay.
So again, BTEC is also arguing inconsistent positions on this appeal and at trial. For invalidity, they're saying that it could be 547 could be any type of A to D converter. And then for non-infringement, they're saying it has to be a multi-slope. So they're saying very different inconsistent positions on claim construction. If you look at the discussion of their expert on the Avery reference, Avery says one sentence, a digital device for converting a digital analog signal to a digital signal. And again, the BTEC expert said, aha, that's A to D converter, and it teaches the 547. So I think it's unfair for them to argue a very broad definition for...
Avery wasn't used to invalidate the 547, right? It invalidated the 052.
It was used at trial for the 547 as well.
But it didn't invalidate the 547.
Right, because the jury found that it was non-obvious.
Right. So they found the 052 invalid and the 547 not invalid.
Yes.
Which would seem to be consistent with the claim construction, suggests that Avery discloses a general A to D and 547 doesn't, but 052 does.
But they're making the argument that at trial and here that the Avery reference, which teaches a generic A to D converter, that it anticipates both of the patents. And so I see your point, but you're saying that the multi-slope, if they're using the definitions, I see that, and I've got to work that through my head if I get back to you on that point.
But you've got rebuttal
time.
In
any event, there really isn't any inconsistency here, is there? I mean, if you're talking about obviousness, or even for that matter, I suppose anticipation at some level, but just take obviousness. If you say, I have prior art that shows all of your limitations, the only difference being that I have an A to D converter generically and you've specified a particular A to D converter, the likelihood is very high that that's going to be a prior art reference that will render your invention obvious, I would think, unless you can point to something really unusual, strange, and novel about having used a multi-slope A to D converter. But that's a different inquiry, it seems to me, from asking whether, for means plus function purposes, you have intentionally clearly limited yourself to a particular type of converter. And I don't see an inconsistency there. Am I missing something here?
No, I don't think you're missing something, Your Honor. And I guess maybe I'll go back to the point is that if you look at the entire record that was before the case, the trial, these are well-known devices, and I believe that somebody of skill in the art would, reading the 547 patent, because these are such well-known devices that they would understand that the 547 patent discloses that.
Okay. Why don't we save the rest of your rebuttal time if you're...
How much time do I have? I'm sorry. Okay.
You've got a little over a minute and a half.
For my 10 minutes, okay. I'd like to go into the 052 a little bit because there's another patent.
Okay.
And a half of your whole 15.
A whole 15?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I'll save that for the rebuttal.
Very well.
Thanks.
Thank you. I didn't understand.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The first issue that the court needs to address in this case is whether the trial court properly limited the means plus function claims of the 547 patent to the structure disclosed in the specification. On that issue, the trial court was correct, and then there's three points that the court inquired about and the counsel addressed that I'd like to pick up on. The first is Judge Moore's question about the claim language that required a multi-slope integrating analog to digital converter. Those are elements 1.3 and 1.4. While 1.4 discusses producing digital representations of load, 1.3 is even more unclear as to what type of structure would be necessary to perform that function. And that element 1.3 is circuit means associated with said counterforce, said circuit means being responsive to external control.
If I can interrupt you for just a second, when you say 1.3 and 1.4, you're talking about claim one and the third limitation and the fourth limitation and so forth?
Exactly.
They aren't designated as 0.3 and 0.4 in the claim, so I was a little confused.
Right, yeah, I'm sorry. I was referring to the chart that was part of the jury instructions at page 114.
Okay.
And we designated them as 1.3 and 1.4.
All right, that's fine.
And so neither of those elements specifically addresses counsel's point about, well, it's inherent in the name. Both of those it is not inherent in the name what structure performs those functions. I think it's also notable that counsel did not point to any place in the 547 patent in his argument where the structure of these two elements is linked, or the function of these two structures or these two elements is linked to performing the function. As to the differences between the 052 patent and the 547 patent, the trial court did in fact address the differences in the specification in its claim construction ruling at page 821. And that portion of the claim construction ruling, the court described the summary of invention section of the 052 patent, which specifically addresses that one or more analog to digital converters are used to obtain a digital representation of the load on each load cell. That same language does not appear at any place in the 547 patent. So this isn't a case where the trial court simply made a mistake. The trial court looked at the 052 patent and its specification individually, and then it took a look at the 547 patent, and based on the differences between the two specifications, exactly as this court's claim constructions rulings require, it interpreted both patents as the specification required. The other point that counsel made that I wanted to address was this issue about Avery being a prior art reference on the 547 patent and Avery only disclosing a general class of A to D converters. The testimony that counsel is referring to is on page 6703 of the record. If you look at page 6703 of the record, what our expert was saying is that Avery meets the function that was interpreted by the court. He said that Avery, I can actually quote what the testimony was. The question was, you use Avery as a basis to tell the court and the jury that element 1.4 is present in the Avery 808, correct? Answer, because it says to digitize a signal. In other words, he's saying that Avery discloses the function. As to the structure, if you look at page 6633 through 6634 of the record, he testifies that Newman is what disclosed the multi-slope A to D converter. And Newman refers to it as a dual-slope A to D converter, but a dual slope and multi-slope are one and the same, and that was also made of record in the trial court. This court's precedent on construction of means plus function claims is very clear that it's the patentee's duty to link structure and function. There's no place in the 547 patent where the patentee did that with respect to anything more than a multi-slope A to D converter. It disclosed a single embodiment, and the trial court was correct in relying on that single embodiment to find that a multi-slope A to D converter is what performs the functions recited in the claims. An important case on this point is the medical instrumentation versus Elekta decision. In that case, the court held that the relevant inquiry in determining what the structure is for a means plus function claim is not what a person of ordinary skill in the art would understand based on their general knowledge. It's what a person of ordinary skill in the art would understand based on the disclosure made in the specification. So the fact that A to D converters may have been known in the art is simply not a relevant consideration under this court's Section 112, Paragraph 6 precedent. I'd like to address the, even though counsel didn't get to it, the issue of the jury's findings on the 052 patent. The jury found the 052 patent both to be invalid based on obviousness and Claim 7, the only claim at issue, not to be infringed. Both of those findings were supported by clear and convincing evidence presented at trial. BTEC, on the issue of the invalidity of the 052 patent, BTEC presented an expert witness, Al Brindell, who detailed where each element of the 052 patent was present in the prior art. He relied on the Avery 808 reference and testified that all of the elements of the 052 patent could be found in Avery. Like the 052 patent, Avery discloses storing correction factors to correct for uneven loading and then applying those correction factors to uncorrected weight readings and summing them to come up with a total weight corrected for load position. Mettler's argument that there's a difference somehow between uneven loading and correcting for load position, that's an argument made in their brief, should be rejected based on the specific testimony that Mr. Brindell gave on this point. He testified that the concepts of uneven loading and correcting for load position are one and the same, and that can be found at page 6599 and 6601 of the record. The jury was correct in accepting Mr. Brindell's testimony on this point and finding that correcting for uneven load position and or correcting for uneven loading and correcting for load position are in fact one and the same. Addressing the verdict of Claim 7 not being infringed, BTEC again presented substantial testimony to support a non-infringement verdict. BTEC presented a testimony from Franco Briganti, the inventor of the technology embodied in BTEC's load cells, and Ben Miller, a third-party expert witness. Both of them explained that BTEC's load cells correct for load position themselves and then send a corrected weight reading to the master controller that's simply summed. So the master controller, the mathematical expression applied to the digital weight readings is simple addition. In contrast, they testified that the 052 patent requires that the mathematical expression applied to the load cell's digital load readings correct for load position. Because BTEC's load cells send pre-corrected signals to the master controller to simply be summed, BTEC could not infringe Claim 7. Aside from this affirmative evidence of non-infringement on Claim 7, Mettler also failed to meet its burden of proof as to infringement of Claim 7. In testifying about Claim 7, which was a method claim, Mettler's expert applied the wrong claim construction. He testified that the, quote, structure and function of Claim 7 were present in BTEC's load cells. Of course, because Claim 7 was a method claim and had not been construed to require a structure and function, Mr. Gaines' testimony, that's Mettler's expert, was wrong on this point as a matter of law. Regarding infringement under the doctrine of equivalence, there was, again, testimony from Mr. Miller and Mr. Briganti that these two technologies could not be interchanged, which, of course, is an important consideration under the doctrine of equivalence.
Is it that they cannot be interchanged, or it's not? It wouldn't be simple to interchange them?
It's that that the scale would not obtain a correct weight reading if they were interchanged.
But isn't it a question of the signal that is sent once the reading is obtained from the scales?
Isn't
it a question of the makeup of the signal that is sent once the reading is obtained from the scales?
The reason they're not interchangeable is because if BTEC sends a corrected signal to the master controller and then you use Mettler's technology, which requires both a correction for load position and summing, you're going to get a correction in the load cells and you're going to get a correction in the master controller and you're going to get an incorrect weight reading. Alternatively, if you use Mettler's load cells with Mettler's master controller, the load cells aren't going to correct and the master controller is not going to correct for load position and you're getting a completely uncorrected weight reading. So that was their testimony as to interchangeability. In addition, under the doctrine of equivalence, the fact that BTEC had its own patent on its technology is a relevant consideration, and that's under the Festo Court versus Shoketsu decision. In that case, the court held that evidence of a separate patent on the accused product is relevant to showing that the differences between the accused product and the patent in suit are not insubstantial differences.
I'm not sure about, but it seems to me your argument on substitutability, interchangeability, isn't really, at least it doesn't strike me as terribly compelling, because if all that's really going on in essence here is that instead of doing an operation downstream in a number of different downstream components, you do exactly the same operation upstream in a single component, then that strikes me as the kind of thing that sounds a lot like doctrine of equivalence type change, a change within the doctrine of equivalence. And that's conceptually not very different from what's going on here, isn't it?
Conceptually correct. Yeah, the load cells are correcting for load position, right. And then the master controller in Mettler's corrects for load position. But there was testimony in addition that these were not insignificant.
If you had a patent on one such device and I decided to get around it, it certainly would be a pretty simple way to get around it. It's just simply to program the operation to some to correct in some at a different point in the sequence of signals, isn't it?
I don't think there was any testimony that it was an easy change to make to allow
to program the load cells to the structures that you had. You obviously have to completely throw them out and start over. But in terms of what the doctrine of equivalence is intended to address, it seems to me that if there is something innovative in an invention, let's say invention X, and you come in and you use the innovative feature of that invention, and the only thing you change is the place you do the calculation in the course of the signal, you probably are going to be at least subject to some substantial problems with doctrine of equivalence, I would think.
A couple points on that. First of all, there was substantial evidence presented before the jury from which the jury could find non-equivalence. And in addition, I would refer the court to column 6 of the 052 patent at line 25, in which the 052 patent says, quote, "The essential feature is that the master controller receive and operate on the digital information from each of the multiple load cells."
Mm-hmm.
So
that is the core of the inventive contribution and therefore not something that can be modified and remain inside the doctrine of equivalence, is your point.
Exactly.
Okay.
I see I'm a little short on time. The last two issues that are involved on appeal, the first is the exclusion of Mettler's reasonable royalty expert. That ruling should be affirmed because the expert admitted that he essentially had no rational analysis for his opinions, and regardless, the trial court allowed Mettler to name a replacement reasonable royalty expert, which was certainly within the trial court's discretion. And finally, on the subject of BTEC's cross-appeal, this court should reverse the trial court's denial of BTEC's sanctions motion. The undisputed evidence presented at trial was that Mettler had documents relating to its manufacturing capacity, such as production schedules, and it consistently misrepresented to both the trial court and to BTEC that it had no documents regarding its manufacturing capacity. It did so in response to a motion to compel. It did so in response to a motion in limine, and it did so at the court's pretrial conference. On the topic of manufacturing schedules specifically, Mr. Long testified that those production schedules were periodically printed off and discarded, and that there was no instruction at any point to maintain those production schedules throughout the litigation. BTEC spent considerable attorney's fees attempting to obtain this information in multiple motions, and we request that the case be remanded for an appropriate
determination.
Wasn't
that motion denied as being untimely filed?
No. The motion was denied because the court said that these documents weren't highly relevant, which we strongly disagree with because, one, our experts specifically attested that these were the type of documents, and the case law, such as the Polaroid case, support this, that these are the type of documents he needed to review to conduct a manufacturing capacity analysis. In addition, because the documents were never produced, the trial court wasn't in a position to assess the relevance of those documents. He didn't have them before him when he decided that they were not highly relevant. Based on their failure to produce these documents, we request that the case be remanded for a determination of the appropriate penalty for these discovery violations. In conclusion, because the 547 patent was appropriately limited to the structure disclosed in the single embodiment in the specification, and there was substantial evidence to support the jury's verdict on the 052 patent regarding both non-infringement and invalidity, we request that the district court's judgment be affirmed.
Let me ask you a question on the sanctions issue, and this goes maybe beyond the immediate four corners of this case, but I can certainly understand why if a judge exercises his discretion to impose sanctions, it's an issue which is, albeit subject to abuse of discretion standard, nonetheless is something that the courts routinely look at. It seems to me that by and large, when judges decide not to impose sanctions, the abuse of discretion standard is applied more liberally than it would be in the case of the imposition of sanctions. Would you agree with that general proposition?
I don't think there's anything in the case law that specifically says that, but I agree if you sort of, the underlying feeling is there that yes, within the case law, right, the courts give a little bit more deference when sanctions are denied.
My follow-up question on that is, do you think there is, in effect, a cause of action for an aggrieved party which is equivalent almost to a tort in a situation in which you're asking for sanctions for discovery abuse, or is it simply something which the court, in order both to ensure that parties comply with court orders and directives and so forth, imposes as principally as a matter of maintaining court order and only secondarily in order to compensate the complaining party for a loss?
As to the last part of your question, yeah, I think it serves both purposes, both to keep the courts, keep the order of the court and to require parties to comply with the court's orders.
And if the court concludes, well, this really wasn't terribly disruptive, I'm not moved. Your argument seems to suggest that, well, nonetheless, because we were injured, the court has an obligation to impose sanctions upon finding that there was misconduct.
Exactly, and that's the second part of the inquiry, is that BTEC was harmed by this. BTEC consistently asked for these documents and was consistently told that everything had been produced. And in those circumstances, when we incurred significant attorney's fees trying to obtain these, we were harmed. And we should be compensated for the efforts.
So you see it, in effect, as if this is almost like a freestanding tort action in which if a judge does not grant you relief, that judge flat out erred.
I wouldn't categorize it as a categorical rule. I would say based on the facts of this case where the court's reasoning really doesn't address the documents, he never received the documents that he says were irrelevant. And as I said previously,
he characterized them. He said they go to current capacity for manufacturing and that's not necessarily reflective of the whole capacity. They go to current production schedule or something like that. That's not necessarily reflective of the total capacity for manufacturing that would be necessary under lost profits. I mean, he recognized that the documents were important. I think he acknowledged that you weren't given them, you should have been, but he also said they weren't that relevant and you weren't harmed by it. You were harmed to the extent you had to move to compel, but isn't the district court just in the best position? I mean, did they file any motions to compel against you in this entire case ever at any point?
I don't recall any.
The only reason I say it is I just feel like there's a lot that goes on in the course of a litigation. And when I'm not the one sitting in the trenches watching it, I don't know who behaved well and who behaved badly. It's like the Santa Claus naughty and nice thing. You know, I mean, I don't have the benefit of seeing the collective behavior of the various lawyers involved in a suit. And he decided, you know, they did something bad, but it wasn't that awful. And, you know, and he let it go. It's hard for me to say. It's almost like a credibility determination of sorts. It's hard for me to go
back. I certainly understand the court's concern, but the testimony is clear of record. They had these documents. They told us they didn't have them. They failed to produce them, and they discarded them throughout the litigation, even after we asked for them, even after we filed the motion to compel.
I think the court also found other circumstances that it considered, including that BTEC filed a motion to compel and for sanctions with the court. And the district court, and I'm looking at page 2 of the court's order with respect to the denying defendant's motion for sanctions. I mean, the court goes through and points out that the a motion was untimely and another motion was denied because it was more of a motion for sanctions as opposed to a motion for documents. So it looks like there was varied facts here that the court considered.
There certainly were a number of facts, and our motion to compel the court found untimely. But even after that, we filed a motion in limine, this issue was specifically addressed at the pre-trial conference, and Mettler again represented to both the court and to BTEC that everything had been produced. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. But you have a little bit of rebuttal time left.
Judge Moore, I would like to get back to your comment about the linkage of the means plus function and how is there any linkage for the claim function of digital representation of a load. And if you look at figure 5 of the 547 patent, you'll see that there's a box that says analog to digital converter right there. And this on the left is a load cell. That's then the load cell is sending the load readings to that A to D converter, which then sends it.
But you see the little number 100, which is what identifies the analog to digital converter. And when you look in the spec, it identifies 100 as being specifically a multi-slope analog to digital converter.
And what I would say to that, Your Honor, is that if the applicant didn't intend this to be broader, I think he would have labeled that box a multi-slope A to D converter instead of a generic A to D converter. So I think that that's evidence that that could be a generic device as well, especially if you combine that with the other portions in the spec where it talks about A to D converters generically. In terms of the linkage to the multi-slope, I don't think that there's any more evidence providing linkage to the multi-slope than the generic A to D converter, and so I think that if there's linkage for the multi-slope, that there's certainly linkage for the A to D generic A to D converter as well. One point I'd like to make for the 052 patent does say common A to D converter, but I would like the court to understand that common in that case means shared versus dedicated. Common doesn't mean generic in the 052 patent when it says common. Regarding the cross appeals that BTEC provided, I think our briefs address those. I'm not going to get into those, but we believe that for the 052, there's no substantial evidence on obviousness or non-infringement because their expert even admitted to the obvious that Avery doesn't teach load correction, position correction, and also that the method claims he admitted were performed. The court, do you have any questions on the 052 and the evidence that was presented?
Well, I guess I would like you to address in a little more detail, if you would. We gave your opponent counsel a little extra time, so we'll do the same for you. But I am, frankly, I'm troubled by the sanctions issue. And it looks to me as if the trial judge may have decided, well, there's some conduct I don't like here, but I'm just not going to impose sanctions. And I'm not sure why the opposing side isn't entitled to sanctions if, in fact, the conduct is improper and imposed costs on them.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Are we talking about the withholding of the manufacturing documents?
Yes.
Okay. We believe that the court found that there was no improper behavior. There was evidence that they knew about these documents months before trial and never filed a motion to compel to get it, that these were not the most relevant documents for determining manufacturing capability, that those documents
But you were under a duty to produce the materials, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
They weren't produced.
They weren't produced, but
so
there was no intent. Yes, but there is no intentional hiding of that information. I mean, you've got a lot of documents. They didn't realize that that was stuff that they had to produce. Again, these documents were not that relevant for manufacturing capability. They just showed the backlog at a snapshot of time. And there was other more evidence that was more relevant to manufacturing capability that was produced. Mm-hmm. So none of this evidence was the most relevant, and there was no intentional hiding of this information, especially when they knew about it months before the trial.
All right. Thank you. I guess we have potential for sur rebuttal, but unless you have one sentence that you would like to add.
I don't think that's necessary. No.
Very good. That's the A answer. Case is submitted.